One of the ways we can think about being on what I'll call the path, but a spiritual path rooted in the Buddha's insight into what leads to lasting well-being is that at the core of the entire system, really at the core of the insight that the Buddha had, even before his so-called awakening, but carrying through into after, was the insight that that peacefulness is pleasurable, that the stopping of stressful processes is pleasurable. And he had this insight in a whole bunch of ways. Before awakening, he had the insight that tormenting the body through intentionally painful austerities was not helpful in terms of becoming free. But he also had the insight that indulging sensual pleasures in the way that he did when he was wealthy also didn't help that much in becoming free. There was too much wanting and desire and grasping in that world. So he went, he realized that, you know, just seeking physical and emotional sensual pleasures didn't really lead to freedom because it was conducive to grasping. You just want more. But denying oneself comfort intentionally, causing pain, also wasn't helpful. That, you know, it led to a kind of brittleness in the heart, a kind of, you know, rejection, really, of aliveness. And so when he comes upon the middle way, he does it by remembering a very pleasurable state of meditation. Maybe we don't even want to call it meditation. He was a kid sitting under a tree in the springtime at a festival. And that's not meditating. Maybe we could call it chilling out. He was chilling out under a tree. But you know, he was doing a thing that kids might do when they're alone. So he wasn't goofing with his friends. He wasn't mugging for anybody. He wasn't like trying to be anyone. He was the kind of kid who could, you know, on a festival day when everyone's doing something, he could sit under a rose apple tree and be so happy just sitting there that his mind and heart naturally settled in a very pleasurable way into the kind of stability that stood out so strongly that he remembered it in his darkest moment. 20 years later. What was that? When he describes it, he says, oh, it was the first jhana, the first meditative absorption. And so the definition of jhana is that it is characterized by vitakka and vichara, or the aiming and sustaining of attention. So there's a kind of gathered and focused attention. Attention that connects and stays connected without becoming distracted. And that there's a settledness or a stillness based in seclusion. So based in it not being caught up in the things around us. So it's a very gentle, and it doesn't say inward, interestingly, or it doesn't say from turning inward. It's really, I read this kind of very simple seclusion as just not being caught up in or fixated on or enraptured by the external environment. So he wasn't like laying there thinking about the rose apple tree. Oh, what a beautiful tree. I wonder, you know, who pollinates it. And, you know, he wasn't doing that. But he was in a beautiful, pleasurable place. He was well fed. He was comfortable. The weather was nice. And his attention wasn't pulled outward. So supported by seclusion. And the primary inner quality or energetic quality that comes up is rapture. It's translated as rapture. The Pali word is piti. You also see it translated sometimes as joy. I prefer joy as a translation for a different word, pamoja. So I like rapture. Bliss you'll sometimes see. It's clearly a physical or embodied energetic quality. And it's connected with these other qualities of focus, steadiness, undistractedness. So this is the turning point in his whole practice. He realizes that this pleasure is actually the way. And so then he goes and nourishes his body. He has a beautiful encounter with a wealthy woman from the nearby town whose name was Sujata, who 20 years before had done a ritual praying for a child at this huge tree outside of town and praying to the tree spirit for a blessing. And she did have her child, whose name was Yasa. Her child was now 20 years old. And in gratitude for having her child, she came out to the tree every single year on the full moon of May to make an offering. And on this particular year, she had an intuition that she wanted to make a very, very special offering. And so she took the milk of 1,000 cows and fed it to 100 cows, and then took the milk of 100 cows and fed it to 10, and took their milk and boiled it down in a new golden cook pot that had never been used for anything else, and stirred it. And in stirring it, not a single drop splashed out, and the bubbles all ran perfectly clockwise, that the stories tell us. And it reached heat without burning or singeing, and it became this perfect, highly concentrated milk rice. And it's said that the gods who knew where this whole thing was going, the gods infused it with heavenly nectar, which is called Amrita, the nectar of immortality, or the nectar of the deathless. And she poured it from the cooking vessel into a golden bowl worth 1,000 gold pieces. And it's said that the milk rice poured from the bowl, from the cook pot into the bowl, like water flowing off a lotus leaf without leaving a single drop behind. And then she covered it with a cloth, and she went out with her maidservant to the tree. And when she saw Gautama sitting there, this young man, gaunt, thin, you know, he had nearly killed himself, starving himself to death. It's said that she had an intuitive memory that she had been his mother 100 times before, in 100 previous lifetimes, and her breasts started to leak milk when she saw him. And she brought him this extraordinary food. And the story says that at first she thought he might be the tree spirit, a kind of embodied form of the tree spirit. And then she realized that he was an ascetic, that he was a human seeking. And she remembered that in her ritual under that tree, she had attained what she wanted. She had her son. And so she gave him the bowl of this extraordinary food, this milk rice, you know, profoundly purified and then hyper purified by the gods and blessed. And she said to him, just as I realized my aim, so may you realize yours. And then it says she turned and left, giving not a single thought to the gold bowl that she had left with him, even as if it were just a withered leaf. She was so generous, and she just wanted to give it. And so, if we take the stories of rebirth seriously, because why not? His mother, 100 times before, came to him and blessed this intuition that the middle way was one of pleasure and ease, and not destroying oneself, not harming oneself for the way, and this extraordinary gift of nourishment. And of course, the cow is mother also in that culture. So, the nourishment of all the mama cows, and his own mother 100 times over. And he ate the food. And then he went to the nearby river and set the bowl in the water. And he said, if this food is to be the support for my full liberation, may this bowl float against the stream. And it's said that the bowl floated right out into the center of the river, into the strongest current, and then floated upstream against the strongest current until it was out of sight. And when it was out of sight of the Buddha, it hit a whirlpool and it spun downward underneath the river to the pavilion of the king of the river spirits, who is a great Naga, the river dragons. And this Naga was thousands of eons old, and he was as old as all of the time of the lifetimes of like the seven past Buddhas. And at the bottom of the river there was a stack of golden bowls, each bowl from a previous Buddha that had undergone the same process. And a golden bowl had been spun in the whirlpool and landed. And the bowl landed with a clink at the bottom of the river on this pile of mythic Buddha's bowls. And the king of the Nagas, for whom all of the cosmic eons between the last Buddha and ours was like a day to him in terms of the length of his lifetime, he said, oh, yesterday a Buddha appeared and disappeared, and already today another one. So that's some of that story. So blessings to Sujata. This is the month of Vesak right now, May. As we would say in a whole different culture, now is the month of May. And Vesak or Visakha Puja is the holiday that celebrates the birth, the awakening, and the death of the Buddha. So we're right in that season. So the Buddha has this intuition into pleasure. And so as we look at the instructions then that he laid out, not just the instructions for concentration meditation, but also the instructions for ethical practice and wise relationship, sila, generosity, the cultivation of the heart qualities of loving kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity. We have all of these methods for purifying the heart, for cultivating the mind. And you know, one of the standard ways we think about them is that we have these tools like focus or concentration and mindfulness or awareness, and then, you know, the shaping of intention in the direction of love, etc. We have these tools and we apply them to the hindrances or the defilements. So as we practice, all the difficult stuff comes up and we try to attend to it. You know, we give it loving attention, we send metta, we give self-compassion, we give compassion to others. We attempt to see clearly that the things that are stressful and bring anxiety, that they arise and pass, that they're impermanent, that they can't really be who we really are. They're not our true self. All of that is a good way to think about practice. That there's a kind of purification. We bring the tools of practice to meet the difficulties of this life. But there's another way, there's a kind of flip side way that we can think about it, which is that the instructions contained in the Dhamma, in the Buddha's teachings, all point toward peace, peace of heart, peace of mind, peace in the world, peace between people, And peacefulness is understood to be pleasurable. So compared to being obsessed by something, being not obsessed is more pleasurable. Compared to being anxious about something, being non-anxious is more pleasurable. Compared to being afraid, being unafraid is more pleasurable. And so we can use this even at the very beginning of our practice, when there's all sorts of defilement and hindrance going on, and in the middle of our practice, when there's all sorts of defilement and hindrance going on, and even when we've been practicing for decades, when there may be, you know, on any odd day, all sorts of defilement and hindrance going on, we can use this instruction. And it goes something like this. Notice how you're doing right now. And notice the best aspect that's happening right now. Notice the good or wholesome qualities. Maybe the mind is really restless and you want to focus on that, it's a hindrance. But maybe you notice that even though the mind is restless, you know, you're happy to be here. Okay, being happy to be here, that's a wholesome quality. That's faith. That's sangha, togetherness. That's appreciation. All right. So listen to that. Notice that. Right? The more you notice something, the louder it gets. Right? The more you listen to a sound in your environment, the more you'll hear it with more detail. So you listen to, oh, but I'm happy to be here. I'm in meditation and, you know, my body's really achy, but it does feel kind of good to be settling, you know, and not moving around so much. Ah, follow that. Follow that. Oh, there's relief. And what we can do is we begin to be connoisseurs, in a way, of pleasure, particularly the quiet pleasures. It's not too hard to become a connoisseur of loud pleasure. And our culture is actually fairly good at feeding you small addictive doses of loud pleasure. But that's not really what is the point here. Loud pleasure often consists of like fast bursts of entertainment, you know, fast-paced things on screens, fast-paced sounds, fast-paced tastes, fast-paced conversations, fast-paced physical interactions. And lots of those are wonderful, you know, and I love them as much as you do. And those are the pleasures that the Buddha recognized in his life of wealth were primarily conducive to increasing desire and want and craving, right? They're, you know, it's like, when my kid figured out what sugar was, you know, he would just grab a sugar packet at the restaurant. He'd be like, can I just eat this? And we'd be like, no. He'd be like, because why bother with the muffin if you can just go for the good stuff? Like, if I know that the good thing in the muffin is the sugar, just eat the sugar. And we would be like, no, it's actually better to eat the muffin. Why? He would say. And the answer is something like, because the pleasure of eating a more healthy thing is ultimately going to be much more satisfying than the spike of eating the sugar packet and then the crash that follows. And he very quickly learned that, you know, if you do eat the sugar packet, you know, while your dad isn't looking, who would never say yes to such a thing, mostly what happens is that you instantly want another one. And so we would talk about that. We say, well, notice that before you noticed they were there, you were actually happy. You were just coloring. We were doing this thing. But as soon as you noticed those and you started talking about it, now then you couldn't think about anything else. And as soon as you tasted it, the only thing you wanted was more of that. That doesn't sound very fun, does it? And he would be like, no, it's fun. I love it. I love it. I like it. I like it. I want to, you know. That's the mind that, when it comes into contact with these loud, fast stimulus pleasures. The Buddha says, look for the pleasures like I found under the rose apple tree, which was a slow pleasure. It was a slow, quieter pleasure, right? He was at a festival. He could have said, you know, oh, I remembered the pleasure of, you know, playing a ball game with my friends, running fast. And that is for real a pleasure. But the one that he remembered was not that, right? He didn't say, oh, playing soccer or whatever it would have been for them at that time, like, that's the path to liberation. Like, just keep playing the game. He got it that the game was, no matter how great the game was, you had to sort of keep engaging in this particular way to keep having pleasure, and that it wasn't sustainable in the way that he wanted. But he thought, what's something that's always available and therefore sustainable? And it was a quiet pleasure that you didn't need anything external to touch into. And so we can use this then as a thread to follow through our day, right? Here I am in the middle of my day and I'm trying to figure out, you know, what I have a pause in my work or something, and a little space opens up. And I get to ask myself, or first, often for me, it's first thing when I wake up in the morning, my family's still asleep. And if I'm lucky, they stay asleep for a few minutes. And I get a little bit of time there where I get to say, wow, what would I like to do with this moment, you know, around dawn? And I can really feel in that moment, I can feel the urge to consume a piece of fast pleasure or to attain a fast pleasure, you know? There's moments when I wake up and I say, oh, I'm up early. This is amazing. I'll just get on YouTube and watch something, you know, or I'll just go and get a piece of chocolate straight away. You know, the Europeans eat chocolate for breakfast, right? And if I'm astute, you know, if there's mindfulness, I can say, oh, what's happening in that moment is that I'm being, there's a kind of flashy thing in my peripheral vision, and I'm not attending to what would actually really, you know, feel good in a deep way. I'm being distracted by something that seems like it's going to feel good in a very immediate but rather short-term way. If I can see that and not fall for that, you know, not bite that fish hook, then I get to say, oh, what actually would be a deeper pleasure? Because, you know, I've had enough experience. I know what it's like to get up and get on YouTube and then an hour later be like, you know, oops, I just frittered away my morning solitude time and now it's time to, you know, do all the things. I know how that feels, you know? I know very well how that feels. And I also have learned how it feels to not do that and to choose to turn toward a quieter and less, it's not always quieter, but like a less externally dependent pleasure. So, oh, get on the yoga mat, sit in meditation, just lay on the floor, go for a walk outside, go visit the redwoods. You know, it almost doesn't matter, but you know what those things are for you. Sometimes it's like, oh, I'm just gonna sit and read. And, but there's a way that the pleasure that comes from those less fixated or dependent activities feels like where I want my practice to go, right? You want to become a connoisseur of like, what are the states that actually feel truly conducive to living a good life? I mean, I want to really have a good life here. What are those states? And how do you cultivate them? And so then it becomes ideally not a kind of force myself to have discipline. And I've done lots of that. I And honestly, I still, on many mornings, I need very much to like impose some discipline. But as I learn more and more, right, there's the sense of not so much, I must force myself to do the healthy thing. You know, oh, I want to watch TV, but I'm going to get on the yoga mat. It's more like, I want to feel good. Therefore, I know how to do that. And the skill of practice actually turns out in part to be knowing what to do to feel really good, like deeply well. And, you know, and we all know that when you do the things that point toward deep wellness, like you get into some stillness or you do something that's really juicy for the body and, you know, for the heart, that, you know, any number of times, often what happens is, you know, your shadows come up. It's not actually pleasurable. I sit down for meditation and, you know, and my mind is a mess and there's all sorts of hindrances. Yeah, I should have just watched television. But what we're going for is not even like, okay, so not every meditation is like the rose apple tree. Like, it's totally not. I know that. But over time, what comes out in the wash is the descriptions that you all said in our little go-around, that there's, you know, there's this thing that's reliable, that, you know, that there's a deeper rest or a clarity of seeing or a self-compassion or, you know, a deeper stillness or a different kind of presence. And you learn to feel that not just as a thing that you're training in, but actually as, you know, one of the most pleasurable moments of your day or of your life. And when you hook into that, then you're really in. And that's very helpful for the discipline of practice. Renunciation doesn't work well if you have to force it. Sometimes that's okay, but mostly it's better to fall in love with the things you call your disciplines. You meditate because sitting down and getting still and you know, setting down the stories and the work, that, you know, whether or not it's pleasurable in any particular moment, overall, you can tell that it's a force for goodness and that there's a kind of deeper ease growing in your life because of it. This turns out to be the same, it turns out to work the same with the ethical practices. You know, at first, maybe you're like, you know, I will not, you know, I will not take life, and you have to work really hard not to slap mosquitoes. And, you know, I will not take things that are not given, and you have to work really hard to not, what, steal people's stuff? I don't know what you have to not work hard for that. You know, you work really hard on, you know, subtler elements of consent or something. And, you know, they're, oh, you know, not committing sexual misconduct. Maybe for a while I have to work really hard at, like, am I flirting in a wholesome way or an unwholesome way? How do I do that? You know, you wrestle with your relationships. You wrestle with, you know, little white lies or big dark lies. I don't know what you do, you know, and you wrestle with intoxicants. You know, am I using them in a mindful way and not in a mindful way? What should I do? All the things. It's appropriate to do that. But the pathway is the same, that you learn, oh, when I act in certain ways, you know, when I restrain myself from lashing out, or when I use kindness instead of sarcasm, when I, you know, when I tend my social roles, using the precepts as a guide, oh, it's just more pleasurable. Like, maybe it's not as exciting in the way that it was when I was hanging out with my crew of people and we were, you know, shooting the shit and bashing people, cutting people down all the time. Like, you know, that was a fast, sharp pleasure. And now, like, oh, the quiet pleasure of being polite. I so much prefer it, you know, because it's, because what I want is just to feel good. And it's like, oh, you know, I grow up and I stop caring as much about what other people think of me, and now I just want to feel good. And as it turns out, that intuition in relationships, in meditation, you know, in all these areas where practice, is what we're doing, you can just follow that. You can follow that thread. And whenever you're confused about what to do, one possibility is to say, well, what would really feel good? And if you notice that what comes first is one of the fast, sharp pleasures, then say, okay, that would feel good, but what would feel good in a more reliable way for longer? So you don't need to say what would feel more good, because, you know, I could always be like, wow, you know, I could eat a whole bunch of chocolate, have some orgasms, you know, whatever, like, you know, but like, okay, but what would be more sustainable than that? You know, and it's like, well, how about, you know, how about being at ease? How about the mind being at ease? And so then you figure out how to cultivate that and say, oh, you know, and you can just follow that. That can really be a compass going forward. All right. I'll pause there. Pleasure.